welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. And I have brought back somebody you haven't heard in a while, so it's awesome that we have him back. We have Chad. How's it going there, Chad?
What's up, Liberty people? I'm glad to be back. I've missed all of you very much, but even though we haven't heard from each other in a while, you were never far from my thoughts. I've since migrated to Northern New Jersey, which is a beautifully, beautifully terrible state, but still the same old dude. New environment, but haven't changed a bit.
And we also have somebody new this time around. Somebody I've been trying to get on the show for a while, and that is Matt. How goes it, Matt?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, the smooth voice. That's because of his beard.
It's a very powerful beard.
Thank you.
He looks a little bit like he might be in ISIS, but
that's going to be relevant.
Definitely in ISIS.
So, before you joined ISIS, Matt, so what were your political leanings before you joined ISIS and libertarianism?
Yeah, I'm a libertarian ISIS member. If I wasn't on a watch list before, I sure am now. So before I became a libertarian, I was raised in a pretty conservative Christian home. Conservative, not politically speaking, but like ideologically. And then was also fairly conservative. I remember during Bush's, during like 9/11, Bush's term, I was sympathetic to him, I suppose. But then I ended up, the first election I could vote in was 2008, and I voted for Ron Paul. And then I voted for Ron Paul again in 2012. And through college, I was exposed a little bit to libertarianism, libertarian thought, and in philosophy classes, reading some Hume and Rousseau, that kind of thing. I was getting exposed to the concepts of natural law and individuals, individualism, individual rights. My dad started reading and following Gary North, and he would share stuff with me, and that was kind of my first exposure. So then I, in one of my research writing classes in college, I wrote a paper about the connection between inflation of the money supply and totalitarian governments. And so I did a lot of research for that that really exposed me to people like Mises and Hayek and Joe Salerno and others like that. So that was kind of started developing the basis for it. But really, when I really started getting into it as a much more of a hobby and a lifestyle, was about a year ago, and started talking to a friend of mine who turned me on to the Tom Woods Show, and I started listening to Tom Woods a little bit. And then I searched for another podcast and found the Jason Stapleton Program, and then joined the group. And then from there, I just started reading. And I kind of reasoned myself to the point of anarcho-capitalism,
as it should be,
kind of on my own, and then started reading, and then got all the like literary and ideological basis for it, and now I'm here.
So wait, Matt, are you saying that libertarians and anarcho-capitalists read things? I've never heard this argument before.
One thing that's interesting is that I've said this before, not many people grew up libertarian. You won't find very many people in our generation who were raised libertarian. Everyone is raised Republican or Democrat, and some people are raised just kind of independent, but very few people are raised libertarian. So if you're a libertarian, almost by rule, you are well-read, and you have considered all these issues, and so then by default, you're typically going to be more intelligent than the average person in the population.
That's a very good point. Thank you. We are smart libertarians. Thank you. Especially anarcho-capitalists.
We're also incredibly modest.
Incredibly.
Lies. I mean, yes, we're modest.
I'm the most modest person, though.
I'm fucking amazing. Anyway.
Modest.
So, anyway. So our topic, unfortunately, is not amazing. Of course, everybody has probably heard the news of the shooting at Pulse Nightclub in Orlando, Florida. And Matt, if you can go ahead and give us the rundown on that.
The quick and dirty details are, it was a guy named Omar Mateen. He's 29, born and raised in the U.S. by Afghani parents. Turns out he was gay, closeted gay. And there's rumors that his father and his ex-wife both were aware of what happened, or what was going to happen ahead of time. But his, I guess his dad was quite a activist, had run for president in Afghanistan or something like that. Anyway, so there was kind of some radical Islam, I suppose, in his heritage. But he, as someone who frequented a nightclub and someone who was gay, obviously probably wasn't quite as much of a radical Muslim himself. But he had what we know to be a Sig Sauer MCX, which is similar to an AR-15, but not an AR-15. It is a rifle, a semi-automatic rifle, and he had a Glock 9mm pistol. The facts that we know is that he entered the club through a side door around 2 in the morning, ended up getting into a gunfight. After shooting a number of people, he got into a gunfight with a cop, who, I think he was either off duty or he was just plain clothes, who was nearby because of underage drinking. And a couple other cops who were nearby showed up, and they got him cornered back into the bathroom with hostages. He was there for 3 or 4 hours before the SWAT team finally showed up, and they used an armored vehicle to bust down the wall of the bathroom so that the hostages could escape. And then Mateen escaped through the hole in the wall apparently as well and died in a firefight with the cops. That is the official story. There was one other point about it as well. Oh, so the total casualties, it was 49 dead and another 53 wounded, I think, is the official tally so far.
Well, oh, goodness. Sorry. Give me a second there. Well, of course, a lot of speculation has happened since, but we're not really going to get into trying to speculate too much because that gets us in a ton of trouble. So instead, we're going to, even though we're going to take into account this case, we're going to talk about some things in broader detail. The first thing I wanted to discuss with you guys, or have you guys talk about mainly, is we see a lot of the similar themes going on in the mass shootings, not just here that we've seen at the Pulse nightclub, but in Brussels and all of that. And we've been seeing for a long time. And a slogan that I really hate having to hear is the war on terror. And, of course, a war on an idea sounds like the stupidest thing ever. And just like when you talk about the war on drugs and the war on, it's just like as soon as you talk about a war on something, we have more of it. So in regards to the war on terror, like, what are your comments on that in regards to these mass shootings and the war on terror in general in the U.S. and what in the heck is going on?
The war on terror, I think, is, well, I don't think, I know that the war on terror is in the large part what precipitated this shooting. Witnesses who were inside the club said that one of the things that Mateen was shouting as he was shooting them was that it was because of the United States foreign policy, and he was saying something to the effect of, this is because you won't stop bombing my people. If you do a little bit of surveying of history, and then really you just use a little bit of common sense, you understand that the radicalization of Muslims, despite the fact that Islam itself has violent roots, the extreme radicalization that we've seen over the last couple of decades is because of heavy intervention by Western countries in that region. And I mean, it makes sense. If you look at how distraught and up in arms we are about this one event, then how would we be affected by a country that has spent the last couple, like a decade and a half, bombing, drone striking, invading, and just generally fucking around with our society. There's going to be a lot of anger, a lot of hatred, and it's only going to breed more and more violence. So with the United States, with our presence in the Middle East, our attempts to stabilize, quote unquote, are just promoting more instability, and it's actually putting us in even greater danger. So while we're pursuing our own interests over there, we're actually compromising our own interests by inviting this type of thing, this type of blowback. And so I think the mass shootings at large, despite the fact that the media doesn't want to state this because the media is far from free, and these entities have claimed responsibility for various attacks, and they've told us exactly why they've happened. They've told us this is because you're over in our country killing our people. Yet we decide to blame it on other things.
Chad?
Yeah, so one of the statements that is just one of my favorite statements to repeat, because it's so just unbelievably and disastrously wrong, is, you know, following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, George W. Bush came out and said, you know, they hate us because we're free. To which, you know, a lot of people just sort of subscribed and bought that idea wholesale. To a lot of Americans, history started on 9/11, and they, or if you're a Republican, you know, recently, history started when Barack Obama was elected. The true history of you know, radical Islam and this sort of violent jihadism is both sort of much, much older and much, much newer. There, you know, if you look at the sort of the life of the Prophet Muhammad, you know, his, I can't remember the exact statistic, but I think it was during the last 9 years of his life, he averaged one event of jihad a month. You know, so there sort of is this this route back to sort of the very foundation of the religion. But when it comes to Islamic terror being a major geopolitical force, that really goes back to sort of the Jimmy Carter era and the Cold War. When people are talking about America starting it, they're entirely right. We actually decided, you know, we made this sort of moral calculus, if you will, that, you know, in the 1960s, communism was the true enemy. And the Soviet Union was attempting to expand its sphere of influence into the Middle East, gain control of the immense oil resources that were, you know, plentiful down there. And keeping with our doctrine of containment, we were trying to fight the Soviets in sort of every way possible. And so, you know, in some cases that took the form of, you know, popular nationalist democratic type movements, and but in many, many other cases we went with religious fundamentalist right-wing extremists. We did this in Afghanistan, we did this in Egypt, we overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran in favor of the Shah. You know, we've been stirring the pot, you know, adding weapons and money to this equation on the side of the right-wing radicals in the Middle East for literally 50 years. And a lot of the sort of more contemporary modern examples of us just really making foreign policy blunder after foreign policy blunder go back to Iraq War I. You know, after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, Dick Cheney sat down with the King of Saudi Arabia and persuaded him to allow American troops into the kingdom, which, if you know anything about the history of Islam and sort of the tenets, crusader boots on the soil of the land of the two holy mosques is a big, big, big no-no in terms of the rules of Islam. But so the king of Saudi Arabia said to Dick Cheney, All right, I have two conditions for you if you guys come. First of all, don't pussyfoot around. Don't, you know, if you're gonna bring the troops, do it right. Bring a big enough force to get this done correctly. And second, promise me that when this is over, that you guys will leave. That little handshake deal between Cheney and the King of Saudi Arabia resulted first in Operation Desert Shield, and then second in Operation Desert Storm, where we went in, you know, rolled back, kicked Saddam out of Kuwait, decided not to topple Baghdad. But then the crucial error that we made is we decided to welch on the second part of the agreement. We stayed in Saudi Arabia, and we've been in Saudi Arabia ever since. You know, we station our, I think it's our fifth fleet of the U.S. Navy. We station it in Bahrain, which is a tiny island emirate right next to Saudi Arabia. We've got over 800 military bases all around the world. You know, we're still occupying Germany. We're still occupying Japan. We still occupy Korea. It's probably easier to name the countries the United States does not have a foreign military base in it than it is to name the countries that do. So, you know, when people say that, you know, America started this whole process, we absolutely did. And, you know, each and every opportunity we've had to ratchet it back and to sort of remove ourselves from attempting to either overtly or covertly dictate what happens in Middle Eastern countries, we've decided to double down, and we've gone the opposite. We've become more interventionist. And this is really something that the right and the left are both equally guilty of. They just happen to spin it in two different ways. You know, with the right, they just want to, the right just wants to kill people.
True.
Am I still being recorded?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so the right, they just want to drop bombs. They just want to kill people. Like Ted Cruz said during the debates, you know, they want to make the sands and the deserts of the Middle East glow. That was Ted Cruz talking about carpet bombing the Middle East, which is, you know, a giant war crime, and something that I have no doubt that he would seriously consider. You know, but the left in America, which is supposed to be the anti-war left, you know, they're all about humanitarianism. They've got a little favorite tactic that they like to call humanitarian interventionalism, which, you know, when you start listening to them talk about it, the first thing they'll always bring up was the genocide in Rwanda. Or they also like to bring up the, you know, the Yugoslavian war between Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Kosovo, et cetera. And they essentially say, you know, well, we have to go in there, we have to kill people in order to help them. So this is something, like I said, that both sides of the political spectrum are equally guilty. They both have blood on their hands. And, you know, if we show a little bit of basic empathy for the victims of our ridiculously imperialistic and aggressive foreign policy, it's not hard for us to say, well, if the shoe is on the other foot, you know, if we were being occupied, if we were being bombed, how would we react?
Now, I'm going to pose a question. I'll throw it to Matt first, and then Chad, you can answer after. Is there at all a reason, of course, because the U.S. has been the big brother to a lot of countries for a super long time, so is there any fault or any problem with having bases for particular defense and helping countries at all? Should we continue doing that? Or is this because I have people saying this all the time, because countries like that where you have people being beheaded and women being treated like crap and there's just a bunch of violence and these countries can't defend themselves and so they look to the U.S. to help them out. Is there a problem with trying to help these people out, even temporarily? So what do you think about that argument, Matt? And then Chad, after that, you can answer.
That's a tough question. Before I answer that, I'll just add on to something Chad was saying. With the U.S.'s presence in the Middle East, I don't know how many people know this, but actually Osama bin Laden was an ally of the U.S. As the Soviet Union was invading Afghanistan, the U.S. essentially, I'm editorializing a little bit, but essentially the U.S. said to bin Laden, hey, we'll help you out. We'll supply you with arms and support to drive the Soviets out. And he's like, okay, great. And then kind of similar to what happened with Saudi Arabia, they were like, yeah, and then we'll just leave and we're done. And he was like, okay, cool. And then as soon as they drove the Soviets back, the United States was like, JK, we're staying here now. And that's what them staying there, them welching them at, and then staying there in perpetuity was what really drove all the bitterness and hatred from bin Laden's side. Not to justify what he ultimately did, but that's the background there. And then Saddam Hussein was a puppet dictator set up by the United States because he, I don't know if I'd say he was sympathetic to their cause, but he at least was someone that they could control and someone that they could get along with. He saw things from their side and they could trust him. So they're the ones who established him there in the first place and then ultimately turned around and attacked him. So we've been, our presence overseas has been far from humanitarian. It's been belligerent. And we are not a country that's known for keeping our word. And we're a country of the sword, not a country of aid. So tying then into your question, Kim, I think it comes down to a libertarian concept of property rights. Ultimately, the other country, that's their property. So putting it down onto a small scale, what would you do if you had a feeling that a woman was being beaten by her husband? How would you handle that situation? I think that in some cases, I think it really has to be handled case by case, but in some cases, you may want to just preemptively get yourself involved. But how you go about it, how you handle it, and then how you behave afterwards is the most important part, because it's not so much whether or not you get involved, but if you get involved for genuinely humanitarian reasons and you're able to prevent the slaughter, the oppression of people, you're left with the issue we have there, where now you have a society that's been broken apart, and we can't just install democracy. We can't just install our system of governance there because they have a different culture. You have to allow their culture to sort themselves out the way they're going to be sorted out. And different cultures are different, and we can't expect them to abide by our standard of morality. So I can see a justification in some really egregious situations for preemptively invading and overthrowing an oppressive dictator. But then after that, it really depends on the country and the situation, whether or not you're justified remaining there, and then how you go about supporting them installing a new country, a new system of governance. It gets really messy, and there's such a strong potential for doing more harm than good. So I guess my answer to the question is, I don't totally know, and it depends on the situation, and I don't mean for that to be a cop-out, but it's just such a complex issue that I don't think there's just a simple cut-and-dry answer to it.
Yeah, that's definitely, anybody who answers that question 100% yes or 100% no, you should automatically distrust that person, because, like Matt was saying, these are complicated issues. In theory, there are justifications for using force to protect minorities. There is a moral argument that you should make, that you can make, that if there's an active Holocaust going on, that it is morally just and it is righteous for us to protect those people. The problem tends to be how it works out in practice. There aren't a lot of good examples of humanitarian interventionalism really doing more good than it does harm. It tends to do a lot of harm. It tends to, a lot of times, sort of unite the former enemies against that. There was a great example that Sam Harris had a discussion with Dan Carlin on this exact topic. And Sam Harris is a big proponent of humanitarian interventionism. And he likens it to a domestic violence issue and says, you know, well, what are we supposed to do if you hear your next door neighbor being beaten up by her husband and you fear that he's going to murder her? And, you know, that little thought experiment would seem to get you to say, well, of course we have to go in and protect the wife. But what happens, unfortunately, in a lot of domestic violence cases, and it happens a lot in humanitarian interventionist cases, is that the presence of sort of the outside authority, the outside aggressor, tends to unite the two parties together against that police officer, or, you know, the person seen as the outside aggressor. It's certainly true that, you know, that there are situations where, like I said, like a Holocaust, like we're just deciding to do nothing would be an immoral policy and would not be something that we would be proud of doing. But you also have to look at, so, you know, once you settle on how to practice this, you know, interventionalism to protect the individuals, to protect the minorities, the next question should be, well, who should be doing that? You know, and in the current geopolitical climate, inevitably the answer is either the United Nations or the United States. And, you know, the United States is the de facto army of the United Nations. You know, where humanitarian interventionism can, you know, really sort of successfully be implemented, if at all, you know, it really should be taken care of by countries and groups that are much closer to the situation, you know. So with the genocide in Rwanda, I believe it ended up being Kenya that ended up moving in to help stop that. And that's much, much more preferable than, you know, the United States swooping in on black helicopters, you know, kicking the doors in and basically causing sort of another Somalia type situation where, you know, we're a foreign power, we're not welcome, we don't know the culture, and we're not planning on staying. You know, meanwhile, you've got neighbors of the you know, of the affected country that do have, you know, trade interests, have vested interests, and they're always going to be neighbors of the you know, of the country that's at risk. So, you know, like I said, those two questions are very, very, very difficult questions to answer. But what's definitely not the correct answer is always yes or always no, and always the United States.
Good point. Now I'm going to go ahead and shift gears for a moment here, and I'll start with Chad on this one. So one of the things I, of course, found interesting on the this current case in Florida was the fact of this guy Mateen being gay, and what a conundrum that is if you're of Islamic culture, and being gay is obviously incredibly frowned on in Islamic culture, and what kind of struggle that is, and just the Islamic culture in general and the clash it is, because this guy, he was, I mean, at this point in time, he was supposedly an American, and then at this point in the shooting, he, I guess, was more, I guess, kind of fighting for Islam's cause. But with this, there was just so much culture clash going on here, and I also noticed, of course, with the media, you got the left and the right doing their thing, trying to choose sides, and you got the left over here they do this strange thing where they want to not exactly vilify all of Islam exactly, but God forbid if this guy was a white Christian. So what do you think of that whole thing, Chad?
Well, without a doubt, they wish, the left wishes so badly that it was a white Christian, because all of the rules that they play by when it comes to the attack being carried out by a Muslim go out the window. You know, when the attack is carried out by a Muslim, of course, if you go to Twitter, the first thing you'll see is hashtag not all Muslims. Hashtag Islam has nothing to do with terror. Hashtag the religion of peace. You know, they're very, very much into this idea that you can't, you know, you can't impose collective punishments, you can't profile, you can't, you know, assign collective guilt to a group of people when it comes to Muslims. You know, when it came to Dylann Roof, the shooter in South Carolina, shooting up, you know, a black church and killing, I think, exclusively black people for, you know, racist motives, that playbook gets flipped. You know, it's sort of open season on all white men. You know, there's never, you'll never see hashtag not all white men, hashtag not all Christians. You know, it comes down to the you know, the left's cultural Marxist worldview. And, you know, in cultural Marxism, you have oppressed class and oppressor class. And, you know, the oppressed class is literally free from any possible criticism because any bad behavior that they might engage in is the result of oppression from the oppressor class. So, you know, when, as you're talking about the idea of the identity struggle, without a doubt, this guy, you know, if there's any area where I have sympathy for him, it's being, you know, being unfortunate enough to be born, you know, a gay Muslim to, you know, a father that's incredibly bigoted, you know, it expresses a very, you know, strict interpretation of the Quran. And, you know, let's not beat around the bush. The sentence for homosexuality in the Quran is death. That is what Muslims, you know, Muslims who abide by their text believe that God has decided, you know, for the gays. Another thing that I do want to point something out, just in terms of part of their, you know, part of their theology and part of their philosophy is, however, that if you do die as, and this is something that I'm sure you'll hear, you know, Islam apologists try to obscure, but in the doctrine of Islam, if you die as a martyr, it does not matter what sins that you've committed while you're on earth. You do not have to go through that ultimate judgment day that everybody else has to participate in at the, you know, at the end of time. You get to skip that, you know, go right through the velvet rope. The bouncer waves you in, and you and members of your family are completely free from that process. So in a bizarre way for him, you know, committing this horrible, horrible sin is offset by the fact that he died as a martyr. So, you know, it actually doesn't matter that he's a homosexual and a mass murderer in Islamic theology. It's something that people who want to obscure the subject, they'll talk about the 9/11 hijackers and they'll say, well, these guys were doing coke and going to strip clubs, so obviously they weren't religious, except for the fact that they flew planes into buildings on behalf of their theology. I think, you know, I think that expresses a little bit of religious conviction. And when you look at it, actually, what, you know, in the sort of logical insanity of this doctrine of martyrdom and jihad, these guys had a free pass to commit as many sins as they want because they've got their get into heaven free card. So far from, you know, far from it being, oh, these guys were doing coke, ergo they're not religious, they're, you know, they're doing the most extreme thing possible, so it grants them a license to bang strippers and do blow.
Interesting. Matt?
Especially because he was, it's like he was getting a two for one. Not only was he killing infidels, but he was killing gay infidels. So they're doubly condemned. I just, with what Chad is saying, I cannot wrap my mind around how people can handle the cognitive dissonance of things like gays against homophobia, or LGBTQ against homophobia. I cannot fathom that.
You mean Islamophobia?
Yes, Islamophobia. I cannot fathom that. It just...
Well, yeah, and let's just throw this out right real quick. Islamophobia is a made-up word. It doesn't mean anything. Just like the accusations when somebody criticizes Islam, accusations of racism. That's a complete and utter fallacy. You know, Islam is not a race, and the term Islamophobia, you know, phobia being an irrational fear of, you know, it should be called Sharia phobia or beheadophobia or, bullets to the dome a phobia.
There's nothing irrational about being afraid of Sharia law.
Oh, God, exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah.
If you're not afraid of it, you're an idiot. Because, you know, the first people they're coming for are us, the gays, basically they're coming for everybody that's not them.
I'm screwed, I'm so gay.
Yeah, the idea that, and this is, I want to be careful to say that I know there are lots of very genuine, sincere, peaceful Muslims. And when we speak of this, even if Islam, which I believe Islam at its heart is a violent ideology, but I do believe
it's not just a violent, it's an evil ideology. Everything that Western liberal tolerant democracies stand for is utterly, utterly contradicted by the central tenets of Islam.
Yep. It's violent towards women, it's violent towards children, it's violent towards gays, and there's no place for true Islam in a Western society. The two cannot mix. They're oil and water, and they'll forever be antagonistic to one another.
Not only that, but unlike, you know, when you start having to talk about the, you know, the differences between Islam and Christianity, Islam and Judaism, unlike the other two major monotheistic religions, Islam in its scripture devotes an inordinate amount of time telling its followers how to treat the non-believers, which sort of leaves the realm of religion and enters explicitly into the realm of politics. You know, people, they try to draw sort of artificial distinctions between, you know, what is political Islam, a lot of people call it Islamism, versus, you know, what is just the religious portion of Islam, but...
There is no distinction. Islam is a political theology.
Very center. Islam is a total prescription for how to live one's life. So, you know, there is no line, and any line that you want to draw, because, you know, and I understand why people want to do it, because they know nice Muslim people. But the reason why those people are tolerable and nice is the extent to which they just blatantly disregard all the problematic, I hate the word problematic, but in this case I'm going to use it, all of the extremely problematic ideas that are in their scriptures.
When people talk about Muslims, they're talking about people that they have met here in the States. So they're talking about Muslims who are Westernized. They say, oh, I've met all these Muslims, and they're all so polite and kind and everything. They're Westernized Muslims. I went to Turkey. I spent a couple of weeks in Turkey. Well, it was actually almost 10 years ago now. But it's a very different society. And even Turkey is probably the most secular of all the Muslim countries, the predominantly Muslim countries. And it's not there is no such thing as equality of the sexes. And it's such an angry theology. that just cannot coalesce with Western society. And so trying to force Western society to merge with Islam, and you can say Islam or Islamism, and really, ultimately, there is no distinction, as like we said. So you can try to force them together, but ultimately, one is going to have to win out. And right now, all the tenets of Western society, individualism, equality, like true equality, tolerance, the ability to disagree, all of these, and to reason with one another, all these tenets of Western society are being pushed out. Yes, exactly. All these things are being pushed out. They're being pushed aside, and yet anything Muslim by the mainstream is held up as untouchable. So if one is going to win out, and one is being pushed aside, and one is being revered, which one is going to win out? And then what are the implications for society?
And ultimately, this comes down to something that was a very, very, very stupid idea that we've accepted as, you know, as a mainstream idea in the West, which is that racism is the worst crime imaginable. You know, we now treat racism as literally worse than murder.
Yeah, you got to remember, though, white people, you know, like, I can hate white people. Like, that's not racism. But, like, if you guys hated me, you're totally racist.
I can't even get into the critical race theory. I can't get into the critical race theory bullshit where they go, well, you know, black people can be prejudiced, but they can't be racist because, you know, racism is about power. And, you know, only white people have the power to really, you know, change other people's lives with their racism.
And yeah, I totally
agree. This is wholly born out of collectivism, which, again, is antagonistic to Western society. Because if you're viewing people according to the color of their skin, you've lost sight of the individual, and you're focused on which group that person happens to belong to. And historically, my group happens to be antagonistic to your group, so we have to be antagonistic to each other. And that's bullshit. And promulgating these ideas in our society is what is sparking this type of violence. You have these two collective groups, two collective ideologies being mashed against each other, and one has to win out. And there's a really easy way to avoid all of this. And this is respect people as individuals.
Yeah, it's also super scary that, you know, not even just white people, but especially if you are a white male, oh my gosh. You are screwed. You are the worst if you're a white male. If you are white and you were born with a penis, you are an awful human being.
That's the beauty of something, you know, in the circles of academia, they call intersectionality, where, you know, on the oppression Olympics scale, being a woman gets you extra points, being disabled gets you extra points, being transgender gets you, you know, extra, extra, extra points. But strangely enough, you know, for the Western left, and I don't by any stretch of the imagination understand how they got this way, but Muslims are higher up in their oppression Olympics than gays. Muslims are higher up than blacks. Muslims are higher up than essentially any other group. And so, you know, even when you have a Muslim killing a bunch of gays of varying different races, you get hashtag not all Muslims.
Yeah.
You know, Islam is the religion of peace. I just want to throw a little stat. There's a great website that I like visiting. It's called the www.thereligionofpeace.com. And they track statistics on, you know, violent jihadism. I'm going to pull it up right now. They're tracking the number of people that have been killed during Ramadan. Worldwide. All right, let's see. I Well, I know the number is yesterday, but they might have changed. So I just want to make sure I've got the most recent statistics. Great. Okay. So the infographic says Ramadan Bombathon, day 11.
Oh my.
Terror in the name of Islam. 88 attacks that have killed 713 people in 11 days. Just wrap your mind. In 11 days, they've killed 713 people in the name of Islam.
That is crazy.
The number of terrorism attacks committed by all other religions combined during the same period is zero. The number of people that have been murdered by Islamophobes is zero. And yet Hillary Clinton yesterday devoted the second half of her speech calling out inflammatory rhetoric that demonizes Muslims and makes the problem worse. And it's playing into the hands of the terrorists. This is what we've come to in 2016 as the brilliant libertarian comic Dave Smith is fond of saying, mean words are worse than bullets.
Well, speaking of the bullets thing, we should move on to somehow that every time we have a mass shooting, everybody decides that the solution to it all is to ban the guns. And of course, I always make the argument, I even had like a Twitter battle with somebody, and it's the worst thing ever when you try to make a point and you only have 140 characters, so you're sending like a gazillion tweets, and you have to tell them, it's like, banning guns does not make sense. There are definitely more automobile accidents and that kill people than guns ever. And I was like, you might as well ban cars, cancer, those kill more people, heart attacks, you can just go ban all of that, that kills more people than guns. I'm like, why would you decide to ban the one thing that just scares you? Because there are less gun-related deaths than automobile deaths. So, of course, it's just every mass shooting, all of a sudden, Democrats are like, oh my gosh, ban the guns. So, I would like to hear what you guys have to say on this particular topic, starting with Matt.
So what it's really come down to, I've realized, is people who believe that guns should be, well, they're divided into two camps, kind of, and there's crossover, but the two camps are people who believe guns should be banned and people who believe guns should just be more strictly regulated or restricted. And within that latter group, there's the people who understand how much they're regulated and restricted already and just want more. And there's people who think that they're not restricted at all and that you can walk into Walmart and buy a machine gun. And so they're ignorant and they're just kind of, people like that who have a strong opinion are kind of beyond hope. You can't really communicate anything with them. But the gist of it with the two main categories is the people who want to ban guns altogether are, people say that what's the difference between an anarchist and a libertarian about 6 months?
Yeah, that's what happened to me.
What's the difference? Yeah, same here. So the difference between someone who wants to regulate guns and someone who wants to ban guns is probably about 6 months, or maybe two mass shootings. Ultimately, they try to do this bait and switch where they say, oh, we're not coming for your guns. We don't want to take your guns. But then they'll invoke things like the UK or Australia, where that's exactly what they did. And they'll say, oh, this is a good plan. Even Obama himself has said, Australia is a plan that we should imitate. And what it comes down to is they don't value the reasons why we value possession of arms as much as they value other things. And the analogy that I came up with that I've been wanting to kind of type out and get out of my head, I was thinking about this last night. Gasoline is the primary accelerant used by arsonists. We have no need to use gasoline. There's plenty of other options. You can ride a bike. You can walk. You can use an electric car. We choose to use gasoline. I mean, the only purpose for gasoline is just to cause explosions. So it's an inherently violent thing. So the only reasons that we choose to use it is because it suits our needs and the things that we value the best. And we could choose not to use gasoline, and we could choose to outlaw gasoline, because if it was outlawed, then it wouldn't be used to burn these people's houses down. But we've made a value judgment that our the usefulness of gasoline, what it does for us, is worth more than the risk of people's houses being burned down. And further, it'd be nonsense to try to ban gasoline, because people could just use paint thinner or any other number of explosive accelerants. So banning gasoline would be like, well, yeah, it'll just come up with something different. And that type of reasoning is really apparent to people. That's no problem for them. But you replace gasoline with guns and arson with murder, and all of a sudden the whole script flips, and they don't get it. So ultimately what they don't appreciate is the fact that you speaking generally, are an individual. You are responsible for your own safety. You have property, yourself, your belongings. You are entitled, because of natural law, you are entitled to protect your property. And you have the right to protect your property with the tools that you see most effective, as long as you're not infringing on someone else's property. And ultimately, the greatest threat to an individual is a tyrannical government. So someone was saying the other day, they were saying, well, how does your right to carry a gun preclude my right to feel safe? And my response was, why does your right to feel safe from someone with a gun preclude my right to feel safe from the government? So ultimately, it's a matter of people need to understand that a gun is just a tool, and they may not value it, but I do value it, because it is the means with which I can protect me, my property, my family. And what one person values doesn't preclude what another person values. So there's the utilitarian arguments that you can make about, you can pull out stats and you can throw studies back and forth at each other all day about, you know, places where they've outlawed guns and how crime has risen and all of this. But what it comes down to is people don't understand the threat that their government poses to them. And they're perfectly comfortable just allowing that government to consolidate gun ownership within itself. And then at that point, you have an entity that defines its own laws, enforces its own laws, and is the only one with the means to protect itself and aggress against other people. And at that point, you're hosed.
Chad?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to, you know, to unpack in the whole debate about gun control. I was listening to, so Dan Carlin, who I mentioned earlier, I'm a huge fan of his. He does two podcasts. He does Hardcore History, which I recommend everybody check out, because you can never get too much, you know, great material on history. One of the great flaws in our modern society is just how little people actually know about history.
Or else they wouldn't be screaming for democratic socialism.
The amount that people, you know, currently know about history is actually more indoctrination than actual lessons about what happened in the past. At least our current, you know, government-run educational system can't manage to teach even math nowadays with the Common Core. They can't even teach math without injecting left-wing ideology into it. So the history we do get taught is, you know, oh, slavery, Jim Crow, the civil rights movement. You know, they devote tons and tons and tons of time in school to that. So we get to hear about essentially how awful white people and mostly white males are, you know, what a cancer to society white males are, and the fact that, you know, the world would just be a better place if, you know, if white males would just do everyone a favor and just die.
I mean, it would do me a favor because I just want to date all your girlfriends. Okay, go on to the serious conversation again.
Where I'm going with this argument about history, sorry, and what Dan Carlin was saying was, you know, after 9/11, the government shoehorned in things like the Patriot Act and basically shredded the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment exists essentially in name only nowadays, you know, but just violations left, right, and center of all kinds of former civil liberties were, you know, just brushed aside after 9/11 because our government was legislating from a sort of temporary insanity. You know, we just suffered the largest attack on our soil since Pearl Harbor. And, you know, I think anybody recognizes that the best time to make, you know, cool, calm, collected, rational decisions is never immediately following a gigantically emotional crisis. And yet, when it comes to gun control, that's exactly what happens. That, you know, an event like Orlando happens, and all of a sudden, we have to do something. And, you know, part of it is that the gun control advocates recognize that when there isn't a tragedy to capitalize on, and when there aren't, you know, freshly deceased bodies to, you know, stack up and stand upon the shoulders of, they're never going to get it passed. They're never going to be able to do it. So they need these kind of tragedies to get people to stop thinking logically, to stop acting rationally, and to start just being afraid. You know, because if they can get you afraid, you will hand over your freedoms and your rights in exchange for the illusion of security. It's it also strikes me as, you know, as ironic just how much the left wants to go on and on about how, you know, the police, they're evil racists, and they're shooting unarmed black men in record numbers, and you know, they're just this instrument of oppression of minorities. But we better make sure that those guys, those evil racists that are shooting black men in the streets, those guys should really be the only guys with guns. It's an incredible level of cognitive dissonance that these people engage in, you know, where they hate the cops. They hate the cops one second, and then they love the cops the next. I wish that they would be a little bit more consistent on what is their, you know, what is their position on government. Is it racist and evil, or is it benevolent and, you know, only there to help us and take care of us? Because, you know, you really can't honestly hold both positions. And, you know, as Matt was saying, the examples of tyrannical government, although people want to pretend like they don't exist and they'll never exist again, you don't have to go very far back in time for major Western countries, Germany and Russia, to have utterly totalitarian governments that they inflicted upon a disarmed populace. And when you have a disarmed populace, you can have the rise of a Joseph Stalin or an Adolf Hitler, who were true minority candidates. I think it was like the Bolsheviks represented, during the time when they took over Russia, like 1% of the Russian population. But as soon as the Soviets managed to grab the armed forces, you now had an utterly disarmed population obeying orders from the Soviets at the point of a gun. And, you know, as libertarians and ANCAPs, we're all aware that that's not fundamentally different than how our current society works. You know, we have quote unquote democracy, and we get a vote, we get a say, allegedly, in who points those guns at us to force us to do, you know, what they want. But you know, when you bring up to, because really the fundamental reason behind the Second Amendment is to protect oneself and one's family against the, you know, the greatest evil on earth, which is an overreaching tyrannical state. But God, bring this up to lefties and they'll look at you like you literally just said the moon is made of Swiss cheese. What? You think you're going to fight the government? You think the government is going to oppress you? I mean, the government is there to protect us. The, you know, the police and the, you know, they're our friends. They're our community members. They wouldn't ever, ever try to oppress us.
I'm going to have to, I have to make a comment on that strange one, because of course I came from the left. And I remember writing a blog about this one where it's just like, so everybody's all like, you know, everybody doesn't need to have guns. Like, we can put them in the hands of somebody else. And then you had that shooting with, like, Laquan, like, that guy, McDonald, who was, like, 17, yeah, who, like, straight up was, like, carrying, like, maybe a blade or something like that. And, like, and he got, like, yeah, and he was, like, he got, like, an entire clip unloaded into him, and then, you know, this poop was like, oh, he's supposed to unload his clip, but none of the other cops around him even lifted their guns to unload their clips, so apparently none of his buddies thought they were threatened. And then so everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's terrible that this cop did this. And then all of a sudden there was like the whole entire, like, the shootings happened in Paris and all, like the bombings in Paris and all that, and everybody's freaking out. They're like, oh my God, oh my God. And, you know, I'm like, okay, you guys need to make up your mind. So all of a sudden you were talking about one week the cops are terrible and they're corrupt. And then all of a sudden, you know, people start bombing people and everybody needs to have a gun. Like, you need to make up your mind. Who do you want to have the guns? Do you want the people to have them or the corrupt cops that you just said shot up a 17-year-old and the cops are corrupt? You need to make up your damn mind. Like, logic doesn't seem to apply consistently to people. And I say this quite often. I'm like, okay, if you want to apply logic, you have to do it consistently. That's how logic works. Well, it's consistent. And I don't understand how, especially... You know, it's a common stereotype for a lot of black people, including me, that cops are just not, you know, our favorite. But, so, you know, I'm like, why in the world are so many black people stuck on the left? And, you know, damn well know that we don't really want cops to be having the damn guns. I'm like, why the hell are we stuck on the left? Like, I want a damn gun. I don't want the cops to have the damn gun. They're always staring at me weird.
Yeah. You really, if you're concerned about racists, like, it's a great idea to empower this evil racist institution with all the weaponry known to mankind. You know, that could never result in anything you know, untoward or wrong happening. But I just wanted to throw another great example of just utter conflicting narratives and you know, inconsistent logic. When the Oregon militia took over that highway rest stop that they call a federal building out in Oregon, I jumped on Twitter to just see the reaction, and there were dozens, if not hundreds, of people essentially calling for the police or the military to murder all of these people.
Those people calling for drone strikes on it.
And their rationale was, you know, well, the police treated black people in Ferguson badly, therefore we must kill the guys in Oregon.
You mean when the police stood by and let them burn the city to the ground?
That, you know, and then they arrested a couple of them while they were rioting. That was terrible, you know, and a total violation of their rights and this, that, and the other. So rather than you know, saying, hey, we should treat everyone better and we should stop oppressing people. And, you know, that the police state is really the enemy. It's like, no. The enemy, if you're on the right, it's the left. And if you're on the left, it's the right. And, you know, so if we must use the, you know, ultimately it's the state is the ultimate gun. The control of state power is, you know, a gun more powerful than a million AR-15 rifles. And both sides just want to grab a hold of it so that they can point it at the other side and rob them blind and, you know, and empower their friends and hurt their enemies. And they'll use any amount of mental gymnastics to get to that point. But it was just, I was just trying to say to people, like, pick a side. Do you love the cops or do you hate the cops? Because you can't love them when they're hurting people you don't like and hate them when they're hurting your allies.
But, like, my favorite...
Chad, are you an ANCAP?
Am I an ANCAP? Yeah.
Yeah.
I always say I fall, you know, somewhere between a hardcore libertarian and an ANCAP, but, you know, I'm an ANCAP philosophically, and then when I have to sort of step down and, like, deal in the nitty-gritty of the real world, you know, I probably tend to lean more libertarian just as a recognition that, like, yeah, that's a necessary bus stop on the way to ANCAPistan.
Well, the way...
Yeah, so then speaking as one of three ANCAPs here, the phenomenon you're talking about is... exactly one of the reasons why the state is such a bad thing, because identity politics are inevitable, mm-hmm. and it becomes, the state is like Dr. Evil's death ray, the ultimate big bad gun, and the identity politics Olympics turns into everyone grappling for control of the death ray to insulate their preferred group and give them preferred status and turn the death ray on everybody else. The state is just monopolized violence, and there's just going to be a constant battle over who's going to have control of it and who they're going to try to oppress with it.
Yeah, and rather than saying, well, you know, we really shouldn't oppress anybody, it's like, no, some oppression is not only fine, it's good, just as long as that oppression is directed at the people who are not us.
Mm-hmm.
So another, I'll just, you know, briefly sort of play, sorry, Kim, I'm going to usurp your role as, you know, as bringing up the topics and whatnot.
Oh, what a jerk. How you know, dare you? Whatever, I don't even care. Go ahead.
So the issue du jour right now with the American political elite when it comes to gun control right now is that they're pushing real hard to keep people who are on the no-fly list or on a, you know, quote-unquote terrorist watch list from being able to purchase firearms. So, you know, there's a myriad number of problems with that, but you know, Kim and Matt, if you guys want to jump in and just start pointing out, like, so what are some of the potential pitfalls of this idea? Because, you know, of course, we don't want terrorists to be able to get automatic machine guns, right?
With the bullet button?
Yeah, the bullet button. The most simple, Jason Stapleton actually said this the other day, and I was like, that's a really concise way of putting it. He said, if the bad guys can have them, then the good guys should have them too.
Well, I mean, like the strange thing, I mean, it's said a lot of times, like, if you try to outlaw guns, then only outlaws have them. Like, how the hell could you even stop anybody from having a damn gun? It's like, it's impossible. Like, it's just like, you can do all the stuff to try to stop, like, law-abiding people from having guns, and it wouldn't stop anybody who, like, the people who want to have guns to do illegal things, like killing people, because, you know, taking away somebody's life is, you know, like the ultimate thing is like, if you really want to screw somebody over and do something and take away their rights, take away their life. They're not going to try to do it by legal means if they have to. They're like, well, if you want to do something, I will find a way to do it. So, like, you can try to tighten up everything you want. They will find a way to loop, like, to find, you know, everybody's like, there are loopholes, like, gun show loopholes. I'm like, but you still have to, like, even though they have to ship it to, like, an FFL in order to get you your damn gun if you order that shit online. Like, there are just so many things, and like, I just get tired of, like, hearing the left say there are loopholes. I'm like, do you not understand the damn process that you have to go through even when they try to ship that shit to you?
Of course they don't. They've never tried to buy a gun. Yeah, Steven Crowder has a great video of him going to a gun show and saying, but no, wait, what about the gun show loophole? Like, you can just sell me this gun with no background check, right? You know, and he goes to tons of different vendors, and it's like, nope, nope, background check, background check, background check. And the idea of background checks really is the illusion of security rather than actual security. Because guess what? In this Orlando shooting, as with San Bernardino, the individual in question didn't have a criminal record. So you can background check them up their ass and back again. And if they have no criminal record, all you're going to find out is, guess what? They don't have a criminal record. A background check is not a mind-reading tool. It's not a, you know, you can't, you're not going to subpoena all of their ex-lovers and, you know, former friends and current friends and former employers. Like, there's a limited amount of information that you can find out about somebody via a background check. And what I'm hearing a lot of people sort of suggest when they're talking about tighter background checks and, you know, more restrictions on this and more restrictions on that.
Well, what's also weird is like, you know, you can't always catch the signs because, you know, you could be a situation where, you know, maybe you had some trauma as a younger human being and it doesn't hit you until later. And all of a sudden in your head, you're like, you know what? I decided I'm just going to shoot up these people out of nowhere. So you can have somebody who's just like a regular IT person. And, you know, decided, fuck everybody on this planet in this entire damn building. I'm just going to shoot you motherfuckers up.
Those Jews really are a problem.
I'm going to shoot those Jews up. I'm going to shoot those.
The Orlando shooter was investigated by the damn FBI. Personally investigated by the FBI. What background check is going to be more extensive than a personal investigation by the FBI?
Well, and they want it to be essentially like, oh, well, you know, well, yeah, we don't want them to, you know, start convicting people of crimes they haven't committed, but like, you know, but in this one case, like, we should have done something. And it's like, no, but that's not how the justice system works. Like, you actually have to do something illegal before you are a criminal. And you know, one of the things that that's just bugged me ever since this shooting took place, and I've heard, you know, there's just been hot takes on hot takes on hot takes, is the number of people that when you follow their arguments to their logical conclusion, are calling for very hardcore racial and religious profiling, and yet they're the type of people that says, no, we can't racial profile, we can't religiously profile, we can't do that, it's that, and it's like, okay, you believe that, and yet at the same time, like, you want to stop, quote unquote, these people from getting guns, yet you won't, you know, your left-wing ideology, your political correctness won't even allow you to name who are these people.
Well, I think we are coming close to a close. Are there any closing statements?
Well, I know Matt's, you know, dropping off for a second, so I will fill the the dead air with some, you know, eloquent thoughts from my libertarian brain. But, you know, what ultimately everybody wants is they want less dead people. They want, nobody wants seriously mentally ill people or terrorists getting their hands on weapons and killing people. Nobody wants that. You know, as much as the left wants to paint the NRA's position as exactly that, oh, you know, potential terrorist, go ahead, get your gun. Mentally ill person, go ahead, get your gun. You know, we all want the guns in the hands of the right people, but, you know, the state and legislation are the bluntest possible tools to accomplish any goal whatsoever, whether that goal be reduction of poverty, reduction of drug abuse, reduction of, you know, deaths on highway road, whatever it is. The state is a sledgehammer rather than a pair of tweezers. And so, you know, to accomplish your goal, and of course, it's naturally, it's the statist's first and usually only idea for how we solve some problem is, well, there ought to be a law. You know, and then they're really upset when, you know, Eric Garner dies over loose cigarettes. Like, those laws have consequences. At the, you know, at the logical conclusion of those laws are dead people and people in cages. And so, you know, regardless of the nobility of your intent, just consider that whatever you decide to do, if you do so through the government, even if your idea is to try to reduce the number of people that die from a crime like such as happened in Orlando, you're going to get people killed and you're going to get people arrested and caged using the state to try to solve your problems.
People tend to get, their response to libertarians tends to be in the situation like this, will say, oh, so what, you want us to just do nothing about it? No, I don't want us to do nothing about it. We should have done something. We should have removed the gun-free zone signs, and we should have encouraged people to buy guns, to own guns, to learn how to use them, to take classes on dealing with hostage situations and active shooter situations. Encourage people to learn how to defend themselves, to learn how to defend their loved ones. Encourage gun ownership. Yeah, we don't want crazies. We don't want evil people owning guns, but you cannot prevent them from owning guns. You might make it harder for them to get one, but you're not preventing them from getting one. So the solution is everyone else arm themselves. Be responsible for your own safety and don't neuter people. Don't neuter people's ability to protect themselves.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is without a doubt a necessary step in the short term, you know, but as libertarians, we also want to look, you know, at long-term solutions, and ultimately the long-term solution is that you're going to have to reduce the supply of potential terrorists and potentially severely mentally ill. And, you know, a great way to reduce the supply of that is tell these people to stop beating up their fucking children. Tell these people, you know, when you're going to have a kid, get married to that person. Stay in a healthy marriage. You know, don't impose insanely strict conservative religious ideology.
Oh, man. I'm pretty sure that was going to be an amazing speech, but I think I lost Chad. Wait, is everybody still there?
I'm still here. I think Chad might be gone.
Oh, man. We totally did have a hanging Chad.
Oh, no.
We did get to put that joke in here, man. Oh, man. He lasted over an hour. Well then, I'm sure that was a great speech.
On to what he was saying, I'll add that in addition to teaching people not to beat their children and all of that, when people do have mental issues, don't ostracize them. Love them if they're your family member or your friend. Be kind to people. Respect them. Don't just pump drugs into someone because it's too inconvenient to give them attention and take care of them. The other issue that it's a great big can of worms, but it's related, is the war on drugs. We're creating criminals, and we're creating nonviolent offenders who are being trained to be violent, and we're just creating a culture of violence. And if we really want to end these types of events, then we need to end the culture of violence.
Right on. Do we have a Chad yet? Well, Chad? Bueller? Bueller?
Bueller?
I guess not. Okay. Well, is that all you got, Matt?
That is all that I've got.
All right. Well, it's getting a little late here. This computer crash. That's unfortunate. Oh. Well, I guess we need to wrap it up anyway. So, thank you for coming on in the show, Matt. Now that we've had you on, you've got to come on more often.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. And for everybody else, if you want to get a hold of the show, you can hit us up at newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at Newborn Liberty. You can search out the Facebook page. Just search out Newborn Libertarian. We're also on Stitcher, on Google Play now. I don't even know how the hell you search that out. I haven't even done that yet. And, well, and for Chad and for Matt, thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you next time.